It is my job before God as an employer to be respectful, to be courageous, and to be a servant.
Welcome to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of McKenzie Study Center. Our hosts are Dr. Jack Crabtree and Christine Barber. Jack is a teacher at McKenzie Study Center and Gutenberg College in Eugene, Oregon. By training, Jack is a philosopher, but his real passion is the Bible, having studied and taught it for more than 25 years. Christine is a licensed marriage and family therapist, having practiced for over 20 years in California and Oregon. Along with her husband, Larry, she is employed by the Caris Foundation, a teaching and counseling ministry. In this series, titled Christianity at Work in Relationships, Jack and Christine discuss how God teaches us to trust Him through the experiences of everyday life. Here now are Jack and Christine.
Jack, again, we're talking about Christianity at Work in Relationships. In our last program, we talked about employee and employer relationships. We really talked about the way that we can relate to one another. Today, what I think would be important is how I relate to myself as an employer, as a businessman or as a businesswoman. How would you define a businessman or a businesswoman from a biblical perspective? What should that person look like?
It's fundamentally not different from any other relationship that we bear to one another and to the world. We must be first and foremost a disciple of Jesus, and we should see the business activity that we're engaged in as simply the arena that God has given me, that God has called me to, in which I practice my discipleship. We were talking off the air about the tendency that we see for people to separate their faith from their business practices. How readily people will pursue discipleship in the context of their family and their marriage, their neighbors, their friends, their other relationships. But when it comes to business, it's as if their discipleship becomes more or less irrelevant to that. Business is its own arena, is its own thing, is its own reality, and you just do business the way business works. So you may be just as shrewd or ruthless, however you define it, as your non-Christian business partner or business competitor. You may jump in there and just use the same, employ the same methods, have the same attitudes, be oriented toward your business the same way a worldly non-Christian is, because that's the way you think is the only safe and successful way to do business.
Successful in the sense that I'm going to be able to make the money.
The money, yeah, the bottom line. Uh-huh. Right. Well, I just think that clearly has to be a wrong way of looking at it. I mean, there's nothing in the Bible that ever suggests that we can exempt areas of our life from our discipleship. We are either a disciple of Jesus and are learning from Him and trying to live our life in the light of what He teaches, or we're not. And if we are, then that's got to have some ramifications for how we do business and how we relate to our business activity.
So what you're saying is we need to be instructed by love in every arena of our life. We need to work toward how does that look in our business, even if we don't end up with the bottom line being as successful if we do that. And I think that's a real big rub for people. I need to make this amount of money, and if I am giving my employees raises that maybe they merit, I might not be able to make that much money, so I will put aside my employees in order to get the money.
Mm-hmm.
Those are very tough decisions all the time.
Yes. In America, that it's even hard to talk about it being about money. If we mean my physical material upkeep, because most Americans are pretty well off. It's not even really so much about money for a lot of us as it is about something else. Greed on the one hand, but probably even more subtly, status, power, standing in the community. It's a more emotional, psychological reward than it is a material reward for a lot of people, I think.
Though the two often go hand in hand. If I have a whole lot of money and I can have a very beautiful office and and lots of material possessions, I'm going to then have high status.
Right, exactly. That, and I guess what I'm saying is what seems to drive us often is the status that comes from the things, even more than just the things themselves. I mean, I think we all get bored with things sooner or later, but why do we keep acquiring them? Because I think there's another reward that comes from that, something that speaks to my self-image and my self-concept and so on.
Or maybe just my own security.
Maybe
I think that's more me. I'm not as interested these days in how things look as having security, having a sense of the car I drive is going to be safe. And I want it to have airbags. I've gotten a little scared about accidents, and so I want that kind of security. But there's this other kind of security also of if I have enough money, then I don't feel as vulnerable as I really am, which is an issue in my life. I don't want to have to trust God as much or have to feel like I'm trusting God as much because I have this sense of security in what I have. So it's that and those underlying issues. And I think then we can go to perhaps even a pastor of a church. They may not make any more money if they have 100 people in their church or if they have 1,000, but it looks better if they have 1,000 people in their church. It perhaps brings them security that they are good teachers or they're well-liked or they're successful in some way. And so it's real tough, I think, even for a lot of pastors, to not head toward numbers.
Yeah, exactly. That's an excellent example. I think a lot of us can let ourselves off the hook that we really don't care about money, but it doesn't let us off the hook in terms of having unbiblical goals for our life. Placing my self-concept, my status, my worth, my significance in something that we call success. That a success that would be recognized not by God and the angels of heaven, but a success that would be recognized by my neighbors, the people around me. That becomes really the focus of many of our lives. And it shouldn't be. That's the whole point. Back to the businessman, it's far more important that I be a disciple of Jesus who loves and respects my employees than it is that I have a successful business that the world would recognize as successful. Those priority, again, this is really radical, but it seems to me that I don't see how we can escape that conclusion from the New Testament, but that's clearly got to be the priority for me.
But it comes down, I can hear people saying, you know, and I have a business myself, it comes down to taking a lot of risks.
Mm-hmm.
Ways that I could lose out on getting what makes me feel secure. I know in my own life, Jack, I'm not a businesswoman in the sense of I'm not producing a product, but I am offering a service. And in offering that service, I could compromise what I say to people because ultimately all the people that come to me for counseling are my boss in the sense that they can decide not to work with me any longer, depending on how I work with them. I can't say it is as much now, but certainly I have wrestled with, should I tell people the truth, and then they may leave or be angry at me, or should I take the risk of doing that?
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's much more clear to me, partly because in taking that risk, I've seen people over and over again swallow it, take it in, learn from it, grow from it. But initially, and I had to take a lot of risk asking myself the question, do I want to keep this person and kind of use them for what I could gain from them? Ultimately, that's the problem. Or do I really love this person and give them what I think is good? And I think most often I give people what I think is good, and sometimes I lose them. But not often, and so again, it's become easier for me. But I think that's the question that we're talking about here.
There's a passage in 2 Corinthians where Paul talks about we are not as some peddling the word of God, I think is the language that he uses. There's tremendous temptation faced by a pastor of a church that's identical to what you just described. Do I peddle the word of God to these people? Do I please them with it? Or another time he talks about in the last times, teachers will come tickling people's ears, which I don't know what that means, but I think it means saying things that are pleasing to them, things that they want to hear, giving them what they want to hear. Tremendous temptation to do that when your income, your revenue, your livelihood, or if not that, your success is on the line with whether or not the people are pleased with what you say. And Paul says, I refuse to do that. I can't do that. I'm a servant of Jesus. My job is, my task is, my responsibility is to speak the truth that I learned from Jesus to people, not to give them what they want to hear. And that's exactly the temptation that you're faced with.
Even when it costs me.
Yeah.
And I think that's the bottom line that we're headed toward right now is very often doing what's right, doing what's good, being a disciple of Christ in the context of my work will cost me in some way.
Right. And I think that translates over into the guy who makes widgets for a living as well. Do I cut corners, make a shoddy, terrible product, present it as if it were a good product, but I know that it's inferior? Or does integrity demand of me that to honor the people that I am serving by giving this product to, do I give them the best quality product that I can? It seems to me that discipleship would require that I do that. That's the counterpart to telling the truth in your practice or in a ministry, in a pastorate. The counterpart to that is I give them a product that has integrity. I give them a service that has integrity to it. I work for them. I work hard for them. I don't cut corners. I don't slack off, charge them for time that I didn't spend, that kind of thing. Integrity demands that I am straightforward about every aspect of my business relationship. This is sort of a different point, but where I think you really often see a discrepancy between an employer and his faith is in the way he relates to his employees. There's no excuse for a disciple of Jesus showing anything but respect for his employees. They are not just one more tool in the shop. I can't treat them as just a means to my end of making a successful business or making a lot of money or whatever I'm after. They're not just tools for me to manipulate and coerce and use. They are human beings made in the image of God, equally worthy as myself. They are my peers. God is not impressed with the fact that I have the office and they don't, that I'm the owner of the business and they're not. God is not one least bit impressed by that. They are in an equal standing before God, and I need to treat them accordingly. Recognize that as my peer before God, I owe them the respect that any human being deserves. So any time as an employer, as a Christian employer, I'm disrespectful or I exploit my employees, that's a grave sin. That's an evil. Paul himself talks about that in Ephesians when we read this last week. He talked about the servants and their relationship to their masters, but he also talks about the masters and how they should view the slaves. He says, and masters, do the same things to them. He says, reciprocate, just as the servant is to serve the master as he would serve the Lord. He says, masters should do the same thing toward their servants, their slaves. Serve them as if they were going to serve the Lord.
So employer, serve your employees as though you're serving the Lord.
Exactly, yeah. So masters, do the same things to them and give up threatening, he says. Mm-hmm. Don't use coercion. Don't use your power, your position of power over them. Don't abuse that power. Knowing that both their master and yours is in heaven, and there is no partiality with him. What I just said a second ago, in God's eyes, God is not looking at my status as any different than the employee. He's not impressed by the fact that I'm the employer. That idea that there's no partiality with God is a big one. It's a very important one that we have to come to terms with.
Impartiality meaning he doesn't make a distinction between people in the sense that he expects less godliness from somebody who has the power than he does from the person that doesn't.
Yeah.
He expects both people to have hearts that are sincerely working toward being disciples of his.
In human affairs, we all feel it. If somebody has status, if somebody has power, if somebody has prestige, we treat them differently. We have a tendency to honor them and respect them more readily and to a greater degree. That's just the way we human beings operate. I think especially what it means that God doesn't have partiality is that he doesn't take that attitude. You know, he doesn't walk into the room and dispense more divine grace to the important people in the world.
To the guy in the three-piece suit.
Yeah, exactly.
He's not impressed.
Right, exactly. He has equal regard for the lowly servant who means nothing to any human being. He has equal regard for him as he does for the king. Or it might even be more accurate to say he has no more regard for the king than he does for the lowly servant. He's not impressed by any of us, really, when it comes right down to it.
It is as if for Jesus that we're all standing in a warehouse naked. Nobody's got their hair brushed better, or they don't have any more impressive clothes. We're all just kind of there,
yeah.
And he sees us all the same.
Yeah, exactly.
And I think we as employers can get very big on ourselves pretty easily because people around us are not doing that. People are impressed by our three-piece suit, by our money, by our success, by our big business. And so I can really see it as a big, reasonably big concern for people who are in that position to need to work toward humility very much. And not toward a false humility, not toward, hey, I'm the good guy and I'm just going to be good toward all these people, but truly and honestly from the heart seeing themselves the same as. And I think that's a very, very tough thing to do. I think particularly people who are, say, physicians. They're not only people who have, they're not the most wealthy people, but they tend to have quite a lot of money, and they have this position of also being the healers and looked up to from both those perspectives. And I think they're in a really tenuous position to think of themselves as better than other people.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, physicians are notorious for their swaggering. Where does it come from? It comes from the notion that my profession is my worth, is my significance, is my standing. In objective reality, the reason I'm important is because I'm a physician, or because I'm a lawyer, or because I'm wealthy, a wealthy tycoon, whatever it is. And as long as we have that perspective, then we have to grasp, hold on to it tightly, and we can't let go of it. We can't let go of that prestige. We can't let go of that importance. We can't let go of that superior power over other people. We have to practice it. We have to make it evident. We have to make it manifest. We have to make it clear to everybody around me that I'm a powerful person, because that's my whole identity, and that's my reason for living. We can only let go of that when we find a different reason for living, a different identity. And it comes back to what we were talking about last week again. It's only by recognizing that it's integrity that's valuable. It's being a whole person, a substantive person in my character. And I can be that as a janitor who sweeps the floors, as a ditch digger, whatever, think of any profession that has no prestige, I can be a really substantive person and have no prestige in my job whatsoever.
So what you're saying, Jack, is that we have this idea of wanting to be a man or a woman of integrity, a disciple of Christ, and that has caught our imagination. We are into that. That's what we want. That's what drives us. And from that context, we can then behave in a way that's generous and kind and humble toward the people with whom we work.
Yeah.
But it's got to have really gripped us.
Right, exactly.
And we have to let it regrip us every day, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's this, certainly there's this part of our hearts that gets gripped by it, and we don't have to think about it quite as much over 20 years. You know, it's really what we want, and so it isn't, okay, now what do I want today? But certainly, if we're not there yet, or if we're young, or if we've been on this prestige ego trip for a while, it really takes some discipline and to work toward, what do I want? And to put that before myself, and even to have myself be in an accountability with other people that help me say, okay, what do I want? And I need to go toward that direction
mm-hmm.
with tenacity.
Mm-hmm. The irony of the whole thing is, I think it's evident if we watch and observe. The irony is, I'm going to have employees that are going to be utterly loyal. I mean, not guaranteed, but the chances of having employees who are utterly loyal and want to work for me and want to produce for me and want to do the best job for me is increased dramatically if I respect them,
mm-hmm.
if I treat them as my peers and give them equal regard. I can kind of whip them into shape by intimidating them and threatening them and get them to do what I want because they're afraid of me.
Mm-hmm.
But there's no comparison between that and the employee who would virtually die for me because I have been so good to them and have treated them so well. So even in terms of the bottom line, it seems like a wise and prudent way to relate to people anyway. That's the irony of the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
But
at least over time. I mean,
yeah.
People can take advantage of me if I'm a kind employer.
Sure.
It doesn't necessarily work out that way, but I think what's working out is that I'm having a situation where it's much more peaceful to work.
Right.
And people enjoy being there, and they might
like
even
me.
Stay longer.
Right.
Yeah, they like me. I like being liked. But,
yeah.
You know, I think about somebody that I know that has been in the job for about 10 years, and she doesn't particularly love the job, but she loves the people. She loves her boss. And I think she's just going to stay there because she's treated so well, and she, in turn, treats him well. She doesn't take advantage of him in any way, but when she needs time off, she can get it, and he gives it to her willingly because he trusts her. It's just a really nice kind of setup they have that they've really worked with. So the bottom line works out well. I think it's more difficult when you are in a situation of having a very large company. And Jack, I think where you and I fall short here is you and I don't have a clue what that's like.
Yeah.
And so people out there who do have that experience need to educate us. And I'd encourage them to write in and say, wait a minute, you guys really missed the boat here or there, or here are some of the challenges we face, because neither you nor I have ever been in that situation. We don't face those challenges.
Right.
You know, having millions of dollars on the line is not something I have and will ever have. But I think that still the principles, even though we might be saying them in a more simple way, and I certainly don't think it's this black and white. I think there's really hard gray areas where people have to really struggle to know what the right thing to do is. Still, the principles generally are the same. And I think Jesus says it, or... Or who's that? Paul says it really well. And so I just want to read it again. It's, and masters, do the same things to them. That is, treat your employees as as God would want you to treat him, as unto the Lord. And give up threatening, knowing that both their master and yours is in heaven, and there is no partiality with him. It's just have respect for these people. Be humble toward these other people. That's across the board. Big company, little company, pastor or businesswoman.
I mean, think of what Jesus taught his disciples. I won't get this exactly right, but it will not be so among you as it is among the Gentiles who lord it over the people that are subject to them. And he's telling his disciples, that's not the way it's going to be among you. He who is, wants to be first must be last, or servant of all. He who wants to rule must serve. I totally butchered that, but I got the gist of it. The point that he's talking about is the way a disciple of Jesus supervises and rules other people is by serving them. And he's talking about the highest office, the most prestigious position in the kingdom of God, his apostles, the actual spokesmen for Jesus, the people who have the authority to speak for Jesus himself. If anybody could put on airs, it ought to be the apostles. And he's saying, nope, ain't gonna work that way. You're gonna put yourself in last place. You're gonna be the servant. That's what's going to be the basis of your authority, is the fact that you serve other people. I don't see how that can be any different than how we act in the business world. The best, a disciple of Jesus in managing other people is going to manage them by serving them. It's that humility that you were talking about. It doesn't cost me anything in prestige, because I don't find my prestige in my status. That's not where I'm looking for prestige. So I can easily give that up. I can let go of that. It's the people who can't let go of that are the people who have nothing else to hang on to. They need that prestige.
You know, that makes me think. I made a phone call to a psychiatrist several weeks ago. And the psychiatrist answered the phone with, hello, I'll use a different name. Hello, this is Dr. Smith. And I thought, wow. Okay, Dr. Smith. Dr. Smith knows that she is talking to a colleague that's regarding a person that we both work with. I hate to use the word client, but I'll use that in this case. Our mutual client, we both work with in different ways. And this person kept referring to themselves as kind of a big person, an important person, a strong person, doctor person, and kind of kept kind of putting me in my place, so to speak, because I'm master's level, and this person has a PhD, and I really felt that strongly. Mm-hmm. And I remember at one point in my life thinking, you know what? I thought that in this conversation. Boy, I should just go back to school and get a PhD, and then I could be Dr. Barber. You know? And it's like, come on. So you know what I started doing? I started saying, and this is not her name either, but, yes, Mary, I appreciate you telling me that. Or, Mary, what do you think about this situation? I started using her first name just to kind of confront that. And I know that's really my issue. But it's this, I know in school that what we are taught as counselors is to place ourselves in a power position over, and I think even using the word, our patients, is making them less than us. It's that thinking that we know more, putting ourselves in a position of there's so many ways that they do it, and it just, to me, it just kills people. And I know I've said this many times, but here I am on my soapbox again, is I can't imagine a counselor or a psychologist helping somebody who they think is different than them.
Mm-hmm. And it's inferior to them.
Yes. What gives me a place to talk to people is to know that at some level, I carry the same burden of guilt as they do. Might not do it in the same way. I may have learned from it and grown up from it for years, and they're just starting in the process. But nonetheless, we share the same heart, and that's where we can help each other. That's how we serve each other. I think that's how you put servant into practice, by recognizing I am like you are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's good. When I was the first year out of college, I went into an intern program at a church. I had a friend who graduated the same time I did, who went off to seminary. And the next summer we had contact with each other, and we were kind of catching up and comparing notes. And I'm not even sure how this came up, but He was telling me that in seminary, what they had taught him is that if you're teaching a passage of the Bible, you're preaching on that passage in Sunday morning, and you're just not sure what the passage says, go ahead and confidently teach something anyway. Doesn't matter that you don't know what it says, but you don't want to, you don't in any way want to undermine the congregation's sense of your authority. So you don't at all, don't ever be tentative. And I just found that outrageous. I mean, that, you know, what an outrageous thing to teach pastors. But I think it's related to your psychiatrist friend and that whole phenomenon of...
He's not my friend.
Oh, okay.
She's not my friend.
this whole phenomenon of keeping my position of prestige and status and power and power over you, authority over you, whatever, and how important that is to people. I'm sure that to an extent it works, that there are people in our congregations who want life to be easier than it really is, and they want there to be a person who just has all the answers for them. And so those people are going to respond to me playing the role of an authority figure. They're going to respond to that, and they're going to be attracted to that. That's true, but there's no integrity to that relationship. Far better that I tell the truth about myself, and that is, I may have more education than you, I may have logged more time studying than you have, but when all is said and done, we're bumbling through this together, so join me in bumbling through it and trying to understand. That has a lot more integrity to it.
Yeah, we got a letter that I was looking for it while you were talking. We got a letter that I know that I've referenced in our program before, but I think I'd like to read it because it speaks exactly to what you're saying. This person says, "But in my close to 3 decades in the church, I can count the number of times I've heard leadership being honest to the point where they really showed themselves in a negative light without somehow redeeming themselves at the same time. It is not that failures and errors are never revealed by leaders, but in my experience, they are typically revealed in such a way as to make the leaders look strong, good, and different from others. I was taught that leadership should only reveal sin in the most carefully controlled ways." And they went on to say how hurtful that had been to them. But I think that's saying exactly what you're saying, is we're trying to cover up, and that cover up is really in no way being a servant, being a disciple to Jesus in the way that we're called to be as leaders, as pastors, as business people.
And we try to turn that, what is really a weakness and a lack of integrity, into a virtue by calling it professionalism. I mean, that's just the professional.
That's a professional way to do it. I remember a story my husband tells. We both went, in undergraduate, we went to a university where we were required to have a Bible minor. And one time, we were in this Bible class, or my husband was in a Bible class, and the teacher was teaching these 3 points out of some passage. And my husband had his Greek New Testament there because he had just finished a couple of years of Greek, and he was trying to put the passage together with the Greek. And he couldn't do it. And it just didn't make sense to him. And so he raised his hand and he asked the teacher, how he put these two together, because he just didn't see it. And it wasn't, he was kind of in a humble way, because he figured the teacher probably did, but he just couldn't figure it out. He was just this student and was trying to figure it out. And the teacher paused for a little bit and he said, "Well, it isn't there." Which I really give, you know, he said, "It isn't correct," basically. And I give the teacher a lot of credit for that. But the result of that was that my husband ended up getting some really, I can't remember what happened exactly, but he got a lot of backlash from that. And he found out very explicitly that that was occurring.
What was occurring?
That he was, the teacher was getting back at him.
Oh, I see.
For my husband having exposed him, and he was embarrassed. And I think that's horrible. We're even in a Bible class where the most important thing is to teach morality, teach kindness, teach love, and the opposite was communicated to him. That kind of attitude in that school led me to eventually not encourage people to go there, because that is a I saw that as being consistent or too consistent in the pattern of people's relationships with each other there and what they expected of one another. And it really was confusing to me as a very young Christian. I thought this was the pattern that I should follow, and I started seeing that, and it was very discouraging to me.
I suppose I'm going off on a tangent here, but
we're good at tangents.
Yeah, your example raises an important point, and that is whole cultures develop. I mean, like at that university, what you're saying is a whole culture developed that basically supported the teaching staff, the professors, having a certain attitude and taking a certain stand in relationship to the establishing a certain relationship with their students. We always, a disciple of Jesus always needs to be countercultural. We always need to ask the question, not what are all of my fellow disciples doing and how are they behaving and how are they thinking about their job, their profession, their business, whatever. The question is, what's really the right and good thing to do? How would Jesus want me to look at this, not what are all the other disciples of Jesus doing? That's especially true in the business world.
That I must be countercultural there, too.
Exactly, yeah. That just because I know a dozen businessmen who practice it this way, and they're Christians, mm-hmm. so... I guess it must be okay. I can't settle for that.
Well, I don't think that's off the track at all, Jack. You're saying that I need to identify what's right, even if everybody else is going in a different direction, even people that I respect. I need to sit back and ask myself, whoa, am I going in a direction that's good? And not use what they're doing as a as an excuse
right.
to be able to do it wrong myself.
Yeah.
Because God sees me individually.
Yeah.
And wants me individually to be making choices that have integrity.
I maybe this is a cliche, I don't know, but I've heard over and over and over again people will say things like, if you look in the Yellow Pages and a craftsman or a businessman or something has the ichthus in their advertisement, sort of wearing it on their sleeve that they are a Christian.
Well, let's say what an ichthus is. It's the sign
it's
of a
the
fish.
Sign of the fish that
signifies I'm a Christian.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's almost become a proverb that you don't want to go there. You don't want to use them. You don't want to patronize them, because it's become so notorious that the people who wear that on their sleeve are somehow not particularly honest businessmen. Well, you know, that's horrible. It shows the degree to which we are able to compartmentalize our faith. I'm a Christian over here, but when it comes to my business, I don't let that impact the way I do my business.
This is kind of a fictitious thing, but I was reading a book called The Bean Trees, and I'm not finished with it, so I don't know if I recommend the book or not, but there's this business that this woman comes up to, and it's called... I think it's called Praise the Lord, Use Tires. Gee. And I when I read that in the book, I thought, oh, no, you know, this is going to talk about a really business that's going underground, that's, you know, going under and nobody comes to it. And, oh, man, this is going to be awful. I had that sense of what you just said, you know, well, better not go there. And it's really quite delightful, because there's this woman who's just really, she's a great salt of the earth type giving, caring woman. And but I understand what you're saying. We've gotten a bad reputation, almost used God as a way to cover up maybe ruthless and very poor business choices.
Yeah. We use the come on that we're a Christian as a marketing tactic, as a marketing strategy, mm-hmm. but we don't back that up with actually being disciples of mm-hmm. Jesus, mm-hmm. and that's really terrible.
You know, it's very personal in my life. I am a counselor and I am a Christian, and I don't market myself really in any way, but as a Christian and a counselor, I've really had to come up against some moral decisions that are very difficult for me, very... unpopular and sometimes I wonder if I should, I'm not always sure if the powers that be have made the right decisions about how I as a counselor should behave. You know, when it makes me think of when Jesus was asked about taxes, I believe, mm-hmm. and should you pay your taxes? And he said something like, give to Caesar what's Caesar's and finish it for me.
Render to Caesar what's Caesar's and render to God what is God's.
And I think he's making this distinction of, you know, you need to do what's right before God even more than you need to do what's right before Caesar. God's your boss. And with God as my boss, I have to make some really important decisions. And I think that's true for all business people. What kind of decisions do we make with God as our boss? It may be different than what our community around us tells us. Mm-hmm. And that could have some very dire consequences.
Yeah, like as it did for Peter, for example, when the Sanhedrin ordered him, made it illegal for him to go out and preach the name of Jesus.
Yes.
And his response was, well, you have to decide for yourself what's right before God, but as for me, I have to, in my obedience to God, I have to go out and preach Jesus. And sure enough, they arrested him again. But that was the price that he had to pay for an obedience that he really didn't have any option but to give to God.
He chose not to have an option.
Right, exactly. Yeah,
he could,
out of cowardice, have decided to not obey God, but that's really not a valid option for us. We must obey God, even if it means that we disobey the authorities.
So we're talking about two really important qualities of personhood here. One is we're talking about being courageous, that we need to make courageous choices even when it's going to risk things that are very important or maybe dear to us or maybe make us feel insecure. We need to be courageous people in order to follow Christ in a real way. On the other hand, we need to be very humble people, people who are willing to be servants to those with whom we work or who work for us. And I think those are the two principles that we could pull out of what we're saying today. Be humble, be a servant, be courageous.
Mm-hmm. And with that courage, be wise. I mean, oftentimes you'll find Christians who recognize rightly the need to be courageous, and then they will go out to show some kind of dramatic show of courage, but it's really kind of rash and foolhardy.
Like what?
It's courage for the sake of courage rather than... Well, take an example. This is not exactly courage, but for example, we recognize in the Bible that we are not to be greedy and we are not to be materialistic. So we sell everything that we have, give it to the poor, and go off and live a life of voluntary poverty, relying upon other people to take care of us. It's traumatic, but is it really obedient? I don't think so, usually not. I mean, maybe somebody has called individuals to something like that. I can't judge their individual situation. But you can see all kinds of people who are doing that as a kind of grandstanding. Look at my obedience. Look at the courage and the look at the extremity of my obedience. Look at my courage. Look at my whatever.
Well, and maybe for those people, Jack, maybe I can't certainly speak for them because I don't know who you're talking about, or if you're not even talking about particular people. But for some people, it's more courageous to have money than to not.
Absolutely, exactly.
And for them to have to work with the money that they have, and you know, to give it all up sounds, you know, really humble. But maybe indeed it's not at all.
Exactly.
It is a very big thing to have the responsibility for a great deal of money, and to have to use that well, and to have to manage that money. That's a problem I particularly would love to have, but lots of people don't love it, and they need as much counsel about having it and it, having it be okay that they have it and figuring out how to use it wisely as anyone else, and they need to be taken seriously. I kind of feel sad for people who are in that situation, and everybody kind of laughs at them like, oh gosh, I'd just like to be in your position. Even though we might like to be in their position, we're not, they are, and it's tough on them.
Yeah.
You ever encountered that?
Oh yeah, absolutely. if I ever take seriously the responsibility that would come with that, I'm glad I don't have it. I mean, it would be a real challenge. Back to the issue of courage, I could find myself in a position where I decide, you know, here's a risk where I may lose my job, I may lose my livelihood, I will have no means of supporting my family. But, you know, in order to show what a spiritual person I am, what a courageous and moral and principled person I am, I'm going to do this. Maybe that's the right thing to do, but if my motive is simply to try to flaunt my spirituality and my family is going to pay for it, I mean, I have to take into account this is not just about me. This is not just about me proving something to myself or proving myself to God or proving myself to the world or my neighbors. This is going to have a real impact on real people, my family, that I have responsibility for. I better be sure that it's obedience that I'm doing and not some kind of grandstanding, if you see the distinction. It looks like courage, but it's not real courage because it's not real obedience that I'm choosing. I'm not doing the right thing. I'm doing the showy thing. Those are not the same thing.
Even if it doesn't appear showy to other people. Even if it appears like I'm doing the spiritual thing.
Right.
But that's where my heart has to be humbled by the reality of the truth rather than what I want other people to see.
Exactly, yeah.
You know, Jack, I'd like to tie this in with, we were talking about working with hurtful people, and I'd like to work that in somehow to employer-employee relationships. And I have found that there are some bosses that I've had that have been very easy to respect, and I think the same is true for the employer. It's there are some employees that are very easy to respect, and I can pat myself on the back and say, "Hey, I'm really doing a good job." It's kind of like a parent who has an only child, and that only child happens to be easy. And after they have three or four kids, we find out that we're not very good parents because inevitably we're going to not have an easy child. It's going to make us know that we are not such great parents after all. And I think that's certainly, you're smiling.
Yeah.
I have three kids, and all three of them have helped me understand that I'm not such a good parent, and they would tell you so very clearly. But anyway, I guess my point here is that it's easy to respect people. It's easy to deal like a servant and humbly with people who respect us and who, especially with our employees, who want to make us look good, who want to work hard. It's much more difficult to work at people who don't necessarily have a tendency to want to respect us, who we don't rub well with. Those are the people who we particularly need to work harder.
Good point.
With to respect them, to serve them.
Yeah, because I'm in the position of power. If I don't like them, I can just manage to get rid of them somehow. I have that kind of power over them. The thing we need to recognize is there is nothing like, it's what we do with power that reveals our character probably more than anything that I know. I remember talking to one of my colleagues at Gutenberg College who grew up in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, and he said the kind of homespun wisdom that existed among the Upper Michiganers was, if you want to know a person's character, watch how he treats his animals.
I was just going to say that.
Really?
Yes. Yes, I had a teacher that told us that one time.
And I think the reason is because the animals are completely under our... we have power over there, complete power over them. And so my character is going to come out in what I do with that. If I'm abusive with that power, if I'm vicious, if I'm hurtful, if I'm destructive, if I exercise power just for the sake of exercising power, I hurt someone just because I have the power to hurt them, that says awful things about my character.
Mm-hmm.
But if out of that position of power I am kind, then my heart is right.
It's true. I really like what you said, and I'm going to repeat it. It's what we do with our power that reflects most who we are.
Martin Luther said, "The Christian life can sometimes look like a drunk man riding a horse. He falls off on one side, gets back on, and then, trying not to fall off again, falls off the other side. On the one hand, Christians may believe so strongly that salvation comes by faith, they forget the importance of obedience to God. On the other hand, an emphasis on obedience can lead to legalism and pride. And in the midst of this struggle, many Christians find themselves asking, why is there still so much moral weakness in my life? Can I be a Christian if I still struggle with sin? Ron Julian's new book, Righteous Sinners, takes a fresh look at these very real questions. If you've ever struggled with your own moral weaknesses, if you've ever looked in the mirror and wondered whether a believer was staring back at you, if you've ever felt a twinge of terror while reading, "Not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, will enter into the kingdom of heaven," then this book is for you. Look for Mackenzie staff member Ron Julian's book, Righteous Sinners, in a bookstore near you.
In church on Sunday, somebody came up to me and said how much they appreciated me reading a couple of letters from listeners, because they said it really helped them see that other people were listening and that it really related to their own struggles and their own needs. And so what I want to do today, in asking again for you listeners to give financially to us, I'd like to read a letter written by one of our listeners, or at least read part of this letter. She says, "I would like to express my sincerest appreciation to Jack and Christine for their series on sexual purity. The topic of sexuality, to the depth that Jack and Christine are expounding, is very much needed by singles, marrieds, and especially by those who experience sexual immorality by their mates. I was never able to understand the whys nor the consequences of the sin, as well as many other facets of sexual sin, until I tuned in to the program. I must say, not only is this a subject that is very much needed to be defined, but Jack and Christine speak at a level where they are understood by even the most brokenhearted. I look so forward to the program on Saturday mornings and cannot express my gratefulness to both of them for helping me through the most difficult time of my life, and to thank our God for importing the biblical truth to them to impact their listeners. May God richly bless you for touching on a subject that has caused so much pain in the lives of believers, but also has given us a clearer understanding of it at the same time. Thank you for all that you do to the cause and in the name of Christ." So letters like this, both Jack and I and our whole board really, really do appreciate. And we want to ask you to send us letters to tell us what you're thinking. Certainly we've got a lot of positive feedback, but quite honestly, we haven't gotten any negative feedback. If there's ways that you would like us to improve, we'd really encourage you to write us and let us know. We'd also really encourage you to consider giving to this program. The financial support that we have from listeners is very, very important to us. So if you feel compelled to give, even to give a little bit, as much as $1, $10, $25, our program is not that expensive to support. It's about $1,000 a week for 8 stations around the western United States. So please consider giving. And again, thank you. Thank you very much for giving us your input about the program.
You have been listening to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of Mackenzie Study Center. If you would like a free copy of this program, or would like to know more about Mackenzie Study Center or Gutenberg College, you may call us at area code 541-485-4801. You can write to us at 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. And we're also on the Internet. Look for us under Mackenzie Study Center or Gutenberg College. Tapes can be purchased with check or Visa. If you didn't have time to write all that down, I'll repeat it again in just a moment. The Mackenzie staff has worked for years studying the Bible, understanding the world we live in, and pursuing what it means to be a Christian. They desire that their ministry may be valuable to others, but they also know that their efforts are in deep need of God's mercy. You can join the Mackenzie staff in their ministry through their classes, seminars, tapes, and papers. The Mackenzie Study Center is a non-profit ministry entirely funded by the generous contributions of people who believe in its goals and have benefited from its ministry. If you would like to make a gift to Mackenzie, it will be entirely tax deductible. just mail your check to McKenzie Study Center, 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. If you would like to request a free taped copy of today's program, the telephone number is 541-485-4801. Now, on behalf of Dr. Jack Crabtree, Christine Barber, and the other staff of McKenzie Study Center, thank you for listening.